make him an offer he can't refuse.
I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Stuff that dreams are made of.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
One morning, I shot an elephant in my pajamas. How he got in my pajamas, I don't know.
I am big. It's the pictures that got small.
Go ahead. Make my day.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Hello and welcome to Front Row Classics, a production of the Front Row Network of Shows, where we take a look at some of the greatest films ever made. And here's your host, Brandon Davis.
And hello to everybody out there in podcast land. This is the Front Row Network. I'm your host, Brandon Davis. And this is not the usual Front Row Classics episode. This is actually a very special episode. I was able to interview a few days ago Michael Riedel, who has been the theater columnist for the New York Post since 1998. And Michael has just actually written a book called Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway, which has been out for a few months now from Simon & Schuster. You can pick it up anywhere, either physically or through virtually through a Kindle or anything like that. And it is a fascinating book. It's about Broadway in the 90s, all the way up through September 11th, and about how Broadway really reinvented itself within the ensuing decade. And Michael was there and covering all of it. And we'll talk about landmark shows from Sunset Boulevard to Rent to The Lion King to revivals of Guys and Dolls to The Producers. And just wonderful, wonderful anecdotes that he shares in the book. And he conducted interviews with a lot of the people involved in these shows to figure out what was going on. He shares backstage stories, some things that you've never maybe heard before, and just really likes to set the time and place to how theater really reinvented itself and evolved in the 90s. It's a fascinating read. So we will go ahead and jump right in and get started here with our interview with Michael Riedel. And hello, everybody. We are here with the Front Row Network with NPR Illinois Community Voices, and I am thrilled today to be able to talk to Michael Riedel, the author of the new book, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Michael, welcome.
Brandon, good to be with you.
Absolutely. I have been, first of all, I was a big fan of Theater Talk, so I enjoy watching.
were we syndicated anywhere in Illinois? Were we out there at all?
No, but the YouTube channel was available for a long time, so I was able to watch.
Judge how old I am talking about syndication.
I know, but I read your original book, Razzle Dazzle, a couple years ago and really enjoyed it. And so I was excited when I saw this new one came out. It really covers sort of the whole era of Broadway when I was growing up. And then I know it's the era of Broadway that you covered being a columnist for the New York Post. And can you just tell me the genesis of the first of Razzle Dazzle and then this book? How did they come about?
Yeah, well, Razzle Dazzle is a book really about Broadway and New York City in the 60s and 70s and into the 80s. And of course, the 60s and 70s, very tough time for New York City. The city was careening toward bankruptcy. Times Square was not the Times Square of The Lion King and Madame Tussauds as it is today. But it was the Times Square of Midnight Cowboy. It was sleazy, prostitutes, pimps, porn houses, dirty bookstores, all that kind of stuff. And the theater was really in trouble. I mean, back then in the 60s and 70s, most of the Broadway theaters were dark. You know, the popular culture had changed and theater was just not front and center of American popular culture anymore. And I got to know some of the old timers. You know, now I'm the old timer, but they were the old timers when I was a young reporter coming up. People like Jerry Schoenfeld, who ran the Schubert Organization, Jimmy Niederlander, who created the Niederlander Empire, the big theater owners, and some of the old producers. And they would regale me with these stories of just trying to keep this business together back in the 1970s. And so I just had this idea for a book that I could write about the handful of people who really stuck by Broadway in its hour of need and turned it around by, you know, one, saving companies like the Schubert Organization so the theaters weren't torn down. I mean, you may remember in the Stephen Sondheim musical Follies, they all gather at a theater that's about to be made into a parking lot, as the MC says. And theaters indeed were being torn down. They had more value as parking lots back then. So I thought it was an interesting story to tell about the Schuberts, the Niederlanders, people like Joe Papp, who, you know, with Michael Bennett did a Chorus Line down at the Public Theater, and that moved to Broadway and became a sensation. Really kind of saved the business back in those days. And then it took me into the 80s when you had those four big blockbuster shows that really changed the business. Cats, Les Miserables, Phantom of the Opera, and Miss Saigon. Those were four shows that made more money than anyone had ever seen on Broadway before. But, and my book ended ended the beginning of the 90s when one of my main characters, Bernie Jacobs, who also ran the Schuberts with Jerry Schoenfeld, when he died, because that seemed like an era ended when Bernie Jacobs died. He was such a big, powerful figure on Broadway in the 1970s and 80s. And then it occurred to me, well, the story's not done, because when I was covering Broadway, you still had these big British shows, but it was the beginning of the end of the British invasion. And I remember, and I opened my book, Singular Sensation, which is basically the sequel to Razzle Dazzle. And I open it with Sunset Boulevard, which was Andrew Lloyd Webber's most expensive show at the time. It was $14 million. And it was going to be the biggest thing of all time. It was going to be the female Phantom, we used to call it back in those days. But it was riven with scandal. Andrew fired Patti LuPone. She famously sued him and got a $1 million settlement. And he fired Faye Dunaway from the LA production. And at the end of the day, Sunset Boulevard was just so expensive, it imploded and fell in on itself, and it never made a profit. And it did win the Tony Award in 1995, but that's only because the competition was Smokey Joe's Cafe that year, which was a review of the old Newbert Stoller songs. But the year after that, the show that won a Tony Award was a show, believe me, no one, we'd not heard of this thing at all when we were all caught up in the Andrew Lloyd Webber saga of Sunset Boulevard, but this guy named Jonathan Larson was writing this musical called Rent. And so Sunset Boulevard ends, and then Rent opens, and the whole terrain of musical theater and Broadway changes. Now, Rent is young, it's current. You know, Phantom, Sunset, they dealt, you know, in kind of fantasy worlds of the Paris Opera House of the 19th century, Norma Desmond's mind of 1950s Hollywood. But here's a musical that's dealing with young people, using rock music, early hip-hop music, dealing with AIDS, gentrification, the struggle of being an artist in a city that is basically pricing itself away from you, all of those contemporary things. And, you know, after Rent, it became a series of interesting American musicals, including, as I cover in the book, the revival of Chicago, and then leading up to Mel Brooks coming back with musical comedy in the producers. So I thought the 90s were a key decade for Broadway. The Americans got back in power. These shows became incredibly popular. Rent, Chicago, The Lion King. I have the arrival of Disney, the producers. I mean, those shows were as well known in the 90s as any movie or TV show at the time. And then the question was, well, I know how to begin the book. I know I can do the gossip of Sunset Boulevard and then the transition into Rent and what Rent changes, but where do you end it? And then it occurred to me as I got up one morning, making my coffee, looking out my window. And once upon a time, I live in the West Village. And once upon a time, I had a direct view to the World Trade Center. And I remembered September 11th, waking up and looking out my window and seeing this black gash across the north face of the North Tower. And I thought, we really thought that was the existential crisis for Broadway when the terrorism hit here. Because people thought there were bombs in theaters. People thought there were bombs about to go off in Times Square.
Right.
But it was Rudy Giuliani, when he was sane, who insisted he wanted to show the world that New York was not going to be brought to its knees by terrorists. He wanted to show the world that New York was open for business. And the best way to do that was to light the marquees of Broadway. Because what does New York have that no other city in the world has? And that's Broadway. And so he insisted, you know, Thursday, September 13th, 2 days later, Broadway open up. And I went with Mel Brooks to the producers, which was then the hottest show in town. And I stood at the back of the house, and Mel and Anne Bancroft, his wonderful wife, we watched, it wasn't full, you know, people were scared, but we had 600-700 people came, and we watched Matthew Broderick and Nathan Lane lead that audience in tears singing God Bless America at the curtain call. And I thought, you know, that's, it's a hell of an ending to a book.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Growing up in the 90s and knowing all of these shows and everything, it really struck me. I didn't realize how much of a formative decade it was for Broadway until you put everything together in the way that you do. Going back to Sunset Boulevard, though, I've always thought Sunset Boulevard was a really solid show and a beautiful score, but I didn't realize all of the, you know, scandal that just went along with it. And one of the stories I find the most fascinating had to do with Barbara Walters. Can you explain that just a little bit?
Right. Yeah. So this was a story. It's a funny how you get a scoop as a reporter. So I used to go down to the Attorney General's office here in New York City, because when you opened a Broadway show and you had investors, you had to have what they called the offering papers, on file with the Attorney General, which essentially detailed the finances of the show, how much the capitalization was, what the running cost was. And oftentimes they'd have little interesting things like how much the star was being paid, what the contracts were. So you could find some fun stuff there. So I'm sitting in the Attorney General's office and I'm curious about Sunset Boulevard because that's the big show. So I get the offering papers for Sunset Boulevard. And back in those days, you sat in a little room and a lawyer sat with you. They didn't leave you alone in the room with the papers. The lawyer sat with you. So I'm going through the papers and then the phone rings and a woman at our office says, whatever the lawyer's name was, she said, hey, a phone call for you. And the lawyer said, oh, no, first I should preface this by saying, going through the papers, I come to the last page and it lists the investors in Sunset Boulevard. And the lawyer sees me looking and he said, oh, that's not supposed to be there. You can't look at that. And then he gets summoned for a phone call. Uh-huh. So he's gone. I said, well, I'm going to look at it. And I look and I see Barbara Walters, $100,000. Interesting, Barbara Walters investing in Sunset Boulevard. Didn't think too much of it, but I wrote it down in my notebook. A few days later, I'm watching 2020, and Barbara Walters is conducting this interview with Andrew Lloyd Webber about his new musical, Sunset Boulevard. And I'm waiting for her to say, and I should let my viewers know that I have $100,000 in the show. She never did. So I called the publicist for ABC, Martin something or other. And I said, look, you know, Barbara Walters invested $100,000 in Sunset Boulevard. Don't you think she should have disclosed it on 2020 last Friday? He said, oh, well, he was giving the runaround. I said, well, I mean, look, I mean, you know, if I invested in a Broadway show, I'd be fired, frankly, but okay, there you go. And he finally said to me, and this is when I wanted to nail them all. He said, do you really think $100,000 means that much to Barbara Walters? And I remember saying, it may not mean much to Barbara Walters, but means a lot to the readers of the New York Daily News. And we nailed her on the front page the next day, and she had to go on 2020 the following week and apologize. It was fun.
Well, yeah, and I cannot imagine Andrew Lloyd Webber having, you know, three leading ladies all all gunning for him at the same time. I knew about the Patti LuPone and Glenn Close drama, but it was the Faye Dunaway aspect. I missed that somehow. But yeah, it's amazing to have fired LuPone, Dunaway, and then he ends up getting Glenn Close angry at him at the same time.
Yeah, because Glenn Close, she made the show into a big hit. She won the Tony Award. She was wonderful in it. She went on vacation, and because they didn't want to make it look like the show was totally dependent on her, and her understudy went on. They lied about the grosses while the understudy was on, showing that, oh, the understudy pulls in the same amount of money Glenn Close does. And then it was revealed in Variety that they made the grosses up. And that was an embarrassment for Andrew. And then all of a sudden, this letter somehow gets leaked. Glenn still wouldn't tell me who leaked it. But it was a letter that Glenn wrote to Andrew saying, I'm furious. I can't. I made this show. I've carried this show on my back. And to make it look like this show is not dependent on me is an insult. If I could leave now, I would. The only reason I'm staying is because I must honor those little people out there in the dark. I mean, she sounded like Norma Desmond in her letter. But, you know, it was one fantastic scandal after another. And, you know, the kind of books I write, you really want to open with a very dramatic first chapter to grab the reader's attention. And there was nothing more fun to cover. Well, up until Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark.
Yes.
That was fun. That's for the next book.
Yeah. When you went to the opening of Sunset Boulevard, could you feel a sea change about to happen almost? Because it seems like.
Okay. No, you felt. Well, you felt. I agree with you. I think Sunset Boulevard is quite a good show and it has a beautiful score. I mean, I think With One Look and As If We Never Said Goodbye are terrific, terrific.
Yes.
Some of Andrew's best work. And I've always been fascinated by the movie and the story. You didn't really know what was coming next. We certainly had no sense that there was something called rent coming around the corner. Mm-hmm. But you did get a sense, and I do remember feeling this at the opening night. I thought, you know, Sunset Boulevard, it's a very intimate show. It's really only three people. It's Joe Gillis, Norma Desmond, and Max, the butler. It's a triangle. But overladen on this triangle was this heavy set. Because you have to remember, Brandon, back then, people thought everything had to have chandeliers and helicopters and turntables. So the mansion had to fly. You know, it felt very baroque.
Right.
Very heavy for what's essentially a very intimate story. So my only sense was maybe this British spectacle is being pushed just a little too far. And indeed, in the end, it was. And as I said, you know, Sunset Boulevard imploded on itself.
Yeah, and it's amazing how from one year to the other, you go from the spectacle of Sunset Boulevard to the simplicity and the realism of Rent. And it's so ironic that Andrew Lloyd Webber was the one who presented them the Tony for Best Musical.
He did, but the great sadness was he presented to Jonathan Larson.
I know, yeah.
Posthumously, because Jonathan died, as we know, the night before the first preview of Rent down at the New York Theater Workshop. You know, the chapters on Rent, I have two chapters on Rent, mm-hmm. and they were those chapters I think I worked the hardest on, because the story of Rent is very, very well known, very well known. And I didn't want those chapters just to be basically Wikipedia entries. I didn't want them to be clip jobs. So I went back and I interviewed as many people who knew Jonathan Larson, including his father and his sister, and as many people who were in the original production of Rent as I could find, just looking for something new, something fresh. And I guess the thing I discovered was there's a sense that Jonathan Larson was this overnight sensation, that this kid came out of nowhere. He had this great show and he died at the last minute, you know. And by the way, a lot of people think he died of AIDS. Not true. He died of an aneurysm. Yeah. But a lot of people, because of the subject matter, he wasn't gay, by the way, but because of the subject matter of Rent, people assume now Jonathan Larson died of AIDS. But what I learned in talking to his friends and talking to his family was he was not an overnight sensation. He had been in New York for a long time, and he was at the end of his rope, emotionally, financially. He'd had a few shows, almost went, really didn't go. He was working in a diner, but he really was at a point, and he was 35, so he wasn't a kid. He was 35. And he was at a point in his life where if Rent didn't get some traction, he was going to have to give up what he loved most, and that was writing for the musical theater and figure out something else to do. So this was his last shot at it. This was his last shot at trying to make his living in the theater. And the great sadness of it was that it kind of killed him in a way.
Absolutely. And I didn't realize that the night before that dress rehearsal, I knew that he gave one interview, but I didn't realize the circumstances that it was the opera critic, just because it was the 100th anniversary of La Boheme.
Yeah, no, the story originally was not going to be about Rent. It was going to be about the 100th anniversary of La Boheme, and folded into that story was going to be this interview with this kid who's written this modern day version of La Boheme. But, you know, when Jonathan died that night, the good smart editors at the Times realized that they had a tremendous story on their hands. And they really whipped that story up. I mean, they turned a kid who no one had ever heard of before in a show no one had ever heard of before into a juggernaut through all the coverage that they gave Rent. And it was warranted because, you know, the show to this day still really touches people. I mean, one of the most moving moments I had when I was interviewing people for this book, I went out to L.A. to interview John's dad, Al, and his sister, and Julie. And his sister said, you know, and she didn't mean this in a lachrymose way at all. She just kind of tossed it off. But, you know, as a reporter, you hear a quote, and you think, that's my ending to my chapter.
Yeah.
She said, you know, it's funny to me. She said, to this day, we get letters from gay kids who were able to tell their parents that they were gay because they saw Rent. We get letters from kids who are going to commit suicide until they saw Rent. Kids who maybe are transgendering now and can now only be opening about it because they saw Rent. And she said, you know, it's funny. It's just a show my punky little brother did, and it still touches people all these years later.
Yeah, and I think it's safe to say we wouldn't have had Hamilton without Rent.
No, you wouldn't have had Hamilton. Lin-Manuel Miranda saw Rent 35 times. You know, Bobby Lopez, who did Book of Mormon and Avenue Q, saw it 20 times. Pasek and Paul, the guys who wrote Dear Evan Hansen, they're in the musical theater because of Rent. I mean, the importance of Rent cannot be underestimated because it made musical theater seem relevant and a great place to work for young people who probably would have not been that interested in the musical theater had it not come along.
And boy, did it made a bunch of stars. You know, I thought about it, you know, the previous eras in Broadway history, you know, you had all these great star vehicles, but, you know, in the 90s, you know, and even in the modern era, we really, except for revivals, you don't have, you know, the star vehicle anymore, but Rent was a star maker when you think about that cast.
Yeah, well, once upon a time on Broadway, you needed stars, right, mm-hmm. to be in the show to sell tickets. But Rent had nobodies, many of them like Idina Menzel, Adam Pascal, Taye Diggs. They became big stars. And, you know, you can now, I think one of the things that comes across in the book maybe is that Broadway became so important in the 90s that Broadway could make stars. Nathan Lane is a star today because of the theater, not movies, not television, but because of the theater. Hugh Jackman, this is a little bit later, this is 2004, but Hugh Jackman really began to get noticed before Wolverine by doing The Boy from Oz, you know?
Right.
So Broadway in the 90s was making stars. That's how important it was.
Yes. And speaking of Nathan Lane, you mentioned, you know, the 90s was also the return of really the American musical comedy to Broadway. And it really started with, well, started maybe with Crazy for You, I believe Frank Rich said, but then the revival of Guys of Dolls was really one of the big stepping stones.
Yeah, it was funny. When I was thinking about the book, I thought, you know, I guess musical comedy really came back in the 90s. And I remember I was at Crazy for You and loved it. And that revival, Jerry Zaks's revival of Guys and Dolls with Nathan Lane and Faith Prince, that was a big one. And then, of course, it culminated really in the producers, Mel Brooks' show. And I remember thinking, well, that's a good thread, the little theme I can flesh out in this book about the return of the musical comedy. And so I went back to, you know, I reread all of the old reviews of all the shows that I'm writing about. And I went back to Frank Rich's review of Crazy for You, and his opening paragraph says, when future historians write about how the Americans took back Broadway from the British, they can be crazy for you. And I thought he was onto it then, and I'm stealing that idea. Got it now, baby. And he was 100% right. You know, and the important thing about Guys and Dolls was Michael David, who produced it, and Jerry Zaks, who directed it, they did not want to do a revival. They did not want to do an old show. And at the time, revivals were kind of shows that they toured the country for a while, and maybe you'd have an old Broadway star like Robert Goulet or Carol Channing in it, someone like that. They did not want to do that. They wanted to treat Guys and Dolls as if it were a new musical, as if Frank Lesser had just written it and they just heard him play it at the piano. That's why they did not cast stars in it. That's why they went for an unknown Nathan Lane and an unknown Faith Prince. And they designed it and directed it in a way that it was an old-fashioned show that felt modern and contemporary. And indeed, it was so successful that Frank Rich's rave review for the show was on the front page of the New York Times. And it'd been, I don't think, if I'm not mistaken, I don't think a review for a Broadway show had ever been on the front page of the New York Times before.
Wow.
Until Guys and Dolls.
And it really came to be because of a last minute casting decision on Jerry Zaks's part, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, Nathan auditioned.
Yeah.
And he was hilarious. And everybody loved him. But a couple of the producers said, well, the only problem is he's not Jewish. Mm-hmm. Nathan's he's a Catholic boy from New Jersey. Because everyone was thinking of Sam Levine, who played the role originally.
Yeah.
And so they said, hey, he's great, he's funny, but he's not Jewish. So Jerry brought him back in again. And he said to Nathan, he said, look, you know, there's a concern you're not Jewish. And Nathan was like, I'll be circumcised if I have to, anything I'll do to get this part. All right. Jerry brings him in again. And he's even funnier this time around. And everyone's falling off their chairs laughing at Nathan. He leaves the room and they say, he's great, but he's not Jewish. And finally, Jerry lost it. And I detail all this in the book. And he said, look, unless he has to perform a circumcision on stage, it doesn't matter if he's not Jewish. But I interviewed Nathan, and Nathan, we were talking about the reception of Guys and Dolls. He said, well, you know, if you go back to that Frank Rich review, there was one quibble. I said, what? He said, well, I'm not Jewish. And indeed, in the Frank Rich review, he gives Nathan a glowing review, and he said, but he's not Jewish.
Oh, man. No.
You can't win this business.
Yeah, and And, you know, and in turn, of course, Nathan ends the decade and this portion of your book, you know, with one of the biggest musical comedies ever with The Producers.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, yeah, as Nathan said, you know, I finally they allowed me to play Jewish, you know, with no problems when he got to play Max Bialystock. But, you know, the thing about Nathan and Matthew Broderick, they were absolutely perfect casting for The Producers, because Nathan and Matthew they inherited that, the Neil Simon, the Sid Caesar world of that real New York Jewish comedy, you know, Jewish rhythms, comedic rhythms that only people like Neil Simon and Mel Brooks and Larry Gelbart, who were in that Sid Caesar writing room, could come up with. And Matthew and Nathan, because they grew up on that stuff, because they love the movies of Mel Brooks, they love the plays of Neil Simon, they understood it. And I regret to say, I think when they're gone, the new generation, which grew up on Rent, is never going to really able, they're never going to really be able to nail the rhythms of a Neil Simon or a Larry Gelbart, or a Mel Brooks joke. I think it's going to be a lost art. And it's interesting, because as good as The Producers is, and it's a terrific show, and I saw many people in it, many versions of it, it was never as good as it was with Matthew and Nathan. Oh. They understood that world better than anyone else who played those parts.
I imagine, yeah. Yeah. And also going back to revivals sort of coming into their own in the 90s, you know, there was a revival that, you know, as of pre-COVID world was still running, Chicago. And what do you think it was about the revival of Chicago that struck a chord and why it ran for decades after?
Well, Chicago, to me, is it's an absolutely fascinating story about taking a risk when no one believes in what you're trying to do. Chicago, which, as you know, opened the same year as A Chorus Line on Broadway in 1975, was completely overshadowed by A Chorus Line, completely overshadowed. Uh-huh. And it had been sort of a forgotten show. I mean, if you're a musical theater buff, you certainly knew Chicago, but it was not a popular title by any stretch of the imagination. And Encores here in New York, which does concert versions of forgotten musicals, they were doing a concert version of it, four performances only, back in 1995, I guess it was. And John Kander and Fred Ebb, who wrote it, they were so caught up in their new show, Steel Pier, that they didn't even bother to attend rehearsals for this, what they thought was a concert version. And then John Kander, I interviewed him for the book, told me, he and Fred, at one point, they were done with Steel Pier, and they said, you know, we should go over to City Center tonight and check out the dress rehearsal of Chicago, see if it's any good. They were paying no attention to it at all.
Wow.
And John said, now you have to remember, a dress rehearsal for Encores would be full of musical theater fanatics.
Okay? Right.
Not normal people, okay, but musical theater fanatics. And John said, from the opening of that famous muted trumpet, you know, womp, 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 he said the audience went insane.
Wow.
He said every number, and Fred and I were just looking at each other like, we'd given no thought to this show in years. For us, it was a show that really wasn't a big hit. Every number stopped the show with B.B. Newworth and Ann Rankin, Jimmy Naughton and Joel Grey. And they were just stunned. And then the show opens at Encores, gets very, very good reviews from the critics. And two friends of mine, two colorful characters in my book, Fran and Barry Weisler, husband and wife producing team, they go to see, I think, almost the second to last performance of the show. And they're knocked out by it. And they were friendly with John and Fred. And Fran Weisler, she called Fred and she said, Fred, when it moves to Broadway, can you give us just a little piece? We would be so grateful if you'd just give us a little piece. And Fred said, Fran, you can have the whole thing. No one's called. Nobody called. Wow. Everybody thought, well, it's a good concert version, but it's an old show. And it's a concert. And everybody thought, well, you can't open a show that's a concert on Broadway. I mean, you got to have a chandelier. You got to have a barricade. You got to have a flying helicopter. You know, people are paying, get this, the top ticket price back then was $75. Oh, can you imagine? $75. Yeah. But for $75, who's going to go see a concert? Fran and Barry could not get a theater. They couldn't get investors in the show. They couldn't get a theater for the show. And then, you know, one night, their bank wouldn't even lend them money to do it. Uh-huh. So one night, Fran and Barry, who'd been successful on Broadway and maybe had a couple million in the bank, they got into bed together and they looked at each other and said, well, why don't we just do it ourselves? And I remember Fran telling me, she said, we turned out the light. And I thought, oh my God, what have we done? Well, they wind up putting up 3/4 of the money for Chicago. And when it opened, it was well before the pandemic. It was in its, what, 21st, 22nd year on Broadway. And the worldwide gross to date is about $3.5 billion. And I have seen the very large estate that Fran and Barry Weissler bought from the money. But nobody believed in them. Nobody believed that the show could work. But I'll tell you why it worked. Well, one, it's a great show, no question. Mm-hmm. But as I was saying about Rent being contemporary, even though Chicago was an old show, it was absolutely contemporary because what is going on when Chicago opens?
The OJ. Yeah.
The OJ Simpson trial.
Yeah.
And that's what it, how can they see with sequins in their eyes? Give them the old razzle dazzle. If the gloves don't fit, you must acquit.
Right.
That's what Chicago captured in the air. In much the same way, I think if you jump ahead, this is not in the book, but I'm thinking about it for my third book. One of the reasons I think that Jersey Boys was such a success was because it opened at the height of The Sopranos, where that whole world was in the zeitgeist at the time.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it's amazing. Chicago is just one of those shows where every year that goes by, it just seems more and more relevant. It's amazing. That show can do that.
It was probably a little too dark in its day. Mm-hmm. Even in the bad old days of New York City, where a lot of people were cynical in the 70s, Chicago, because it was Fosse, and Fosse was always going as dark as he possibly could.
True.
I mean, Fosse at one point in his career, Fosse was so dark that he wanted to do shows without lights. He would like to turn the lights down. And the producers would be like, Bob, we can't see the actors. You know, you got to, and he was like, make it darker.
Oh, man. Well, speaking of another major event in the 90s, of course, was Disney coming to Broadway and Times Square becoming more touristy and family friendly and all of that. And I know that initially Beauty and the Beast was not well received, but it took The Lion King to finally sort of make the Broadway community sort of come around to Disney being there. Do you remember that time and what it was like when Disney was coming to Broadway?
Well, very much so. I mean, I covered that as a reporter, and I, like many people in the theater, thought this is the end of Western civilization. If I have to sit through Beauty and the Beast, I'm going to kill myself. It was a theme park show, you know? Yeah. But I did admire what Disney was doing, refurbishing the New Amsterdam Theater on 42nd Street, because that was an anchor. That was key to the turning around Times Square and 42nd Street. And I know there were a lot of people, and I kind of was one of them at one point, who thought, you know, do we really want Times Square to be Disneyland? I mean, it was kind of fun when it was rough and tumble, and it was real New York, you know. And we were tough New Yorkers to walk down 42nd Street back in those days. I kind of thought that way myself until I interviewed for my first book, Razzle Dazzle, a guy who was part of the police force fighting crime in Times Square. And I told him that. And he said, look, do you know how many body parts of young women we found in hotels in Times Square? Women we could never identify, chopped up by pimps, killed by their Johns. He said, you think that's a neighborhood that you really want to go on? He said, fine for you, you know, you nice little student from Columbia going down, you know, to walk along Times Square and get a thrill. But what about the people who got murdered there that you'll never hear about? I thought, well, that's an interesting perspective. Yeah. So I did admire what Disney was doing with the New Amsterdam Theater. But, and this is, you know, all credit to Michael Eisner running Disney then. Michael knew that Disney could not get away with Beauty and the Beast again. It was a success, but he knew theater people didn't like it. And so when Michael was talking to the guys running his theater department, Tom Schumacher, who still runs it, and Peter Schneider, he said, let's do The Lion King, but let's do something different. Michael didn't know what. He said, just let's do it in a different way from Beauty and the Beast. And the key thing to understanding is that Peter and Tom, they weren't corporate guys. They were theater guys who wound up working for Disney in the animation department. So they weren't suits, as you would say.
Right.
And they came from, both of them came from the experimental theater. So they knew the work of Julie Taymor. So as they were trying to figure out, who should we get to The Lion King? Tom Schumacher said, well, why don't we just give Julie Taymor a call? And they got in touch with Julie. And when I interviewed her, she said, well, they offered me this job directing a cartoon. I mean, he was not remotely interested in The Lion King, I can tell you. He said, I called it a cartoon. I mean, I'd never seen it before. They sent her a videotape. But Julie likes mythic things, you know? And she worked in the opera. Mm-hmm. She'd worked in the experimental theater. And I'd seen a number of her stuff. And it was arresting and beautiful. It was a little weird, I got to tell you. But it was always interesting. But Julie likes big mythic things. And in The Lion King, she thought she saw the mythic theme. The son must take the father's place. That's a classic in mythology, a classic plot line. And that's what she was attracted to. And then she went to work with her Indonesian puppetry, her bankaru, all that stuff that, believe me, no one at Disney had ever heard of before. And she does all this stuff and she's putting it together. And they do a workshop for Michael Eisner and all the California people, they call them, all the studio people. Mm-hmm. And she's got that lion heads on the actors' heads and all this puppetry stuff going on. But it's done in a brightly lit rehearsal room. The stuff is not painted. It's not finished yet. It's very early stages. And the California people are, what the hell is this woman doing? What are we into? And one of them said, and Michael Eisner, he wouldn't tell me who, but I figured out who it was, kind of his number two at the company then. I was like, I don't understand this thing. What's that thing on the head? Am I supposed to look at the actor's face? Do I look at that thing on the head? Well, what is this? What is this nonsense? This is never going to work. And as they were leaving, Michael Eisner said to Peter and Tom, he said, pull the plug on it. Let's move on to something else. And they got into their SUVs to take them off to their private plane to whisk them back to California. And Peter, Tom, and Julie stood on the curb and they were sick to their stomachs, as Tom told me. But it was Peter Schneider. He said, you know, Julie, we failed you. Your stuff has got to be seen in the proper context. It has to be in a Broadway theater. It has to be finished and it has to be lit. And we have to get it back in front of Michael. And Julie said, give me 2 weeks. And Michael Eisner came back to New York and went to the Palace Theater. And they did three different versions of possible puppetry for The Lion King. The first version was more like what cats look like. The second was kind of a hybrid of cats and what Julie eventually did. And the third was Julie's original designs. Now it was all painted. It was all lit properly by the brilliant Don Holder. And Michael Eisner wasn't on top of it. He was in row 10. So he's back to take it all in. And Michael Eisner, to his great credit, said, you know what? The bigger the risk, the bigger the payoff. We're going with your original vision, Julie. And The Lion King to date, before the pandemic, had grossed $9 billion around the world, making it the most lucrative entertainment title of all time, more than a movie, more than a hit TV show.
I saw The Lion King in Chicago, and that first number, Circle of Life, that's one of those moments in the theater that I don't think I'll ever forget.
Well, I mean, it was a profound moment in my theater going experience, because I went to cover an early preview in Minneapolis, and I was very skeptical because I did not like Beauty and the Beast. And as much as I admire Julie Taymor's work, I thought it was weird. So I couldn't put, and I try to convey this in the book, you couldn't put Julie Taymor with Disney. It just didn't fit somehow. So I remember going out there and I was very skeptical and I thought, okay, you know, it was Tim Rice wrote Disasters in the Air. And I was prepared to pounce, right? And then of course, you know, you sit there and I had my hands on, my arms were crossed. I'm like, okay, all right, let's see what this thing's going to be like. And then, of course, you know, you see that beautiful papier-mâché sunrise and Elton John and Tim Rice's stirring Circle of Life number, and C.D. LaLocca comes out with the Zulu chants. And then you see the cheetah puppet comes out. And then remember the giraffe puppets come loping out. And suddenly you feel this audience is just, they're stunned. They're just stunned at the beauty of what they're seeing. And I remember thinking to myself, oh, my God, I don't have the vocabulary to describe what I'm seeing. How the hell am I going to write about this? Because I don't have the words to tell you what I'm experiencing right now. And by the end of that opening number, Circle of Life, that entire, it was at the Orpheum in Minneapolis, I remember. The audience, they weren't only standing up. People were standing on their seats, screaming and applauding. And I remember going back and meeting Julie and Tom and Peter for the first time. And I try to convey this in my book because I've got to remember, Brandon, people working on a show do not know if they have a hit or a flop. They've been working on it for years in some cases. They do not know what they have. You never know what you have in the theater until you meet your ultimate collaborator, which is the audience.
Right.
And not your friends, but people who paid for their tickets whom you've never met before. And Peter and Tom, they had this look on their face. They were had this terrified look on their faces. And I said, and I remember Julie looking in at me, and she said, "Do you think it's is it going to be okay?" I think you guys have the biggest hit since The Phantom of the Opera. But it was tremendous. But again, I mean, it goes to show you, and I, you know, it's one of the themes I try to get across in the book, is that the show that does not possibly seem like it could go, the one that seems so crazy, you know, a concert version of an old show from the 70s, Chicago, you know, a rock musical based on La Boheme, Rent, Julie Taymor working for Disney. Mm-hmm. These ideas on paper, they sound daft, bizarre, but they're unexpected. And they're so much more exciting than, you know, a movie that was popular and now they're going to make it into a stage musical. Mm-hmm. Or another cartoon that they're just going to do along the lines of Beauty and the Beast, or a revival of a show that was popular 20 years ago. You know, Hal Prince, I think the best thing I ever learned about the theater was from Hal Prince, the great director and producer. Mm-hmm. And I remember going over to his office once, and we were kind of bemoaning the fact that Broadway was becoming a little too predictable, a little too commercial, too many revivals, too many shows based on movies. And Hal said to me, he said, "You know, Michael, in the theater, you can't give people what they know. You have to give them what they could not even have imagined." Huh. And all the shows I write about in Singular Sensation are shows you could not even have imagined. You know, Rent does not exist but for the mind of Jonathan Larson.
Right.
The Lion King does not exist but for the talent and the mind of Julie Taymor. You know, Chicago doesn't exist but for the fact that Encores wanted to do this concert version, and Anne Rankin, who choreographed it and stepped into it the last minute, said, you know, it still has to be in the style of Fosse, because we got to remind people of how good Bob was.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You mention in the book that, you know, and I'm sure you didn't mean for it to be ironic when you were writing it, but that we were in a current golden age on Broadway. Were we with the decade of the 90s, were we still pre-COVID riding that wave that it sort of created?
Oh, yeah. Well, in the 90s, certainly. And in fact, the subtitle of the book, it's called Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway.
Yeah.
A subtitle I never intended to be ironic. But you got to remember, I turned in the manuscript in February of last year. And as a little treat for myself, I took myself on a skiing trip to Switzerland and northern Italy. And one day I went over the mountain, went over the border. I was like the Von Trapp family running over the border. I skied over the border of Switzerland into Italy, and I found this fabulous restaurant on the slopes. And I took a picture of a glass of wine I was having with a Matterhorn behind me, and I texted it to my girlfriend. And she said, "Where are you?" And I said, I'm in Italy. She said, "Do you know what's going on?" I said, "Well, vaguely. I mean, I kind of heard of the coronavirus, but I was frankly paying more attention to the Democratic primary. It was going to be Bernie Sanders or Joe Biden." Uh-huh. She said, "There's spikes all over northern Italy of this thing called the coronavirus." 3 days later, that resort I was in, Cervinia, was shut down because of outbreaks of coronavirus. So I got back to New York, and my book is done, and I'm, you know, still covering Broadway. And within 2 weeks, everything was shut down. And we thought it would be shut down for two. I mean, remember, it'll be 2 weeks. 2 weeks, we'll be back. Well, you know, now we're going on a year here, and until everyone's vaccinated, no end in sight. But I did talk to my editor at Simon & Schuster, and I said, I mean, my book is suddenly completely out of date. I'm celebrating Broadway. I'm talking about its golden age. I'm talking about its resurgence in the 90s. Uh-huh. And he said, "Look, the book is the book. You know, you're not writing about the pandemic. You're writing about a piece of history." He said, "Just write an introduction." So I tried to frame the book by saying essentially what I just told you. I never intended the title to be ironic. Yeah. My third book will be about the successes of Broadway and some of the big failures, like Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark, the successes in the 2000s. And the dramatic part of that book will be just at its height, the thing completely fell apart because of this pandemic. And I'll have to wait and see how Broadway comes out of it. And how it can come out of it is going to be a fascinating story to tell, because you cannot just flip the lights on Broadway again and expect people to come back, people who've lost their jobs, people who are afraid to be together. And you cannot say to people when you reopen Broadway, "Oh, by the way, our tickets are $850 for Hamilton." Yeah. Not going to happen. You got to get rid of those premium prices. And that means the producers and the theater owners and the unions are going to have to entirely rethink the economics of this business. So when they do open up, they can say, come to see our show at a reasonable price.
Yeah. And whenever they do eventually open back up, is it going to be smarter for it to open all at once, or is it better for just a few theaters to open at a time?
I think it's going to stagger. I think a few theaters will open here and there. I mean, I'm a little counterintuitive in this sense. Everybody thinks the big hits will come back first. Wicked, Phantom of the Opera, Lion King. My feeling about that, though, is those shows are entirely dependent on tourists.
Yeah.
The tourists are not going to be coming to New York for a while. Certainly not in the numbers that they once came in. Okay? Mm-hmm. I think the first people to come back to Broadway are going to be New Yorkers. But New Yorkers have seen The Phantom. They've seen Wicked. A lot of them probably haven't seen Hamilton because it was so expensive. So it's at a reasonable price, they'll go to see it.
Yeah.
But if I were a producer, I would look for the new Jonathan Larson. I would look for the new Tony Kushner. I'd look for the new Edward Albee. I would do more adventurous plays and musicals on Broadway to entice New Yorkers back to the theater first, because they're going to be the front line. Uh-huh. It's going to take a while for tourism to come back to the city, I think.
Yeah. There's whole sections in the book we didn't even get to, but yeah, a wonderful, wonderful section about the resurgence of Edward Albee and about,
I mean, I don't want people to think the book is only about musicals.
No,
Angels in America and the return of Edward Albee, great playwright, of course. And then you had those very interesting British plays by David Hare that had people like Liam Neeson and Judy Dench and Nicole Kidman in the 90s. The play came back as the American musical came back in the 90s. So did the straight play on Broadway.
It did. It did. And it's interesting. And I think you're right. I think people are going to be looking for more adventurous things and more, you know, we've all been through a really rough year. We need something that speaks to us more on a human level, I feel like.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. You know, there's a big push now because of Black Lives Matter for more diverse voices on Broadway. I have a little hesitation about that because I don't really think you can program art. I don't think you can say, you know, well, we need a play by this checks this box, that checks this box. You know, there's no box to check for an Edward Albee. There's no box to check for an August Wilson. There's no box to check for a Julie Taymor
right.
or Jonathan Larson or an Andrew Lloyd Webber. You know, they're just creative, talented people. And I don't care, you know, I don't care where they come from. I don't care who they are. But I think you got to judge the work itself, not the kind of person who's writing it. And it's going to be interesting because I know a lot of these theaters here in New York are like, well, you know, and I've heard this from some of my my older white male playwright friends are like, I can't get my plays done. I mean, they've told me basically we can't do your play next season when we reopen because of the push for diversity. But, you know, the one thing in the theater you can't do is you can't put a gun to an audience's head and make them come to pay to see the show. Uh-huh. If the show isn't good, they're not going to be there. So you better find some good shows. And I mean, art is a wonderful thing because it doesn't discriminate at all. If it's good, it works. Simple as that. If the audience likes it, the audience likes it. And the audience doesn't much care who wrote it. Most of the audience going to see shows don't know who wrote it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And Michael, as we get ready to kind of wrap up here, I just want to know what was the piece of theater? What was the show that made you fall in love and want to be within the industry in the way that you have been?
I was never a theater kid. I just kind of drifted into it in a strange way. But I do remember coming to New York when I was maybe 13 or 14, and we saw two Broadway shows. The first one we saw was 42nd Street with Jerry Orbach. And I remember thinking, oh, this is fun. It seemed old-fashioned to me. I mean, you know, it was set in the Depression era. But it was fun. The tap dancing was great. It was lavish and it was fun. The next night, though, we went to see Tommy Toon's Nine.
Oh, yeah.
With that beautiful score by Maury Esten. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm a kid of 14, so, you know, what do I know about an Italian filmmaker who cheats on his wife? I mean, I don't know. But what I was attracted to was Maury's beautiful score and Tommy Toon's swirling staging. You know, just a kind of gorgeous movement that never stopped. And the whole idea of just the only guy in the play is this one man and all these women around him. and what they all mean to him in some way. And it was far more sophisticated for this little kid from upstate New York. But I just remember being struck by the beauty of the staging and the beauty of the music. And I think to this day, when I go to the theater, that's what I look for. I look for something that is unexpectedly beautiful or moving or hilarious. And, you know, it's been my good fortune to have seen some incredible shows. And you know, certainly the 90s, when you go through, we had Edward Albee's Three Tall Women, Tony Kushner's Angels in America, August Wilson's Fences, and The Piano Lesson. That was an early play in the 90s that I remember being knocked out by. And The Lion King and Chicago and Mel Brooks as the producers. It was an exciting time.
Awesome. It may take us a little while to get back there, but I'm looking forward to a time when we can have, you know, another renaissance of that kind of art. So absolutely.
The pandemic is a tough one. It's going to be a tough one to come out of. It's not going to happen easily, I don't think. But it will happen. I mean, Broadway is good comebacks. Broadway just survived the Depression. It survived you know, the collapse of New York City in the 70s. Yeah. And people forget, you know, Broadway survived its own pandemic, and that was AIDS.
Right.
That was AIDS in the 80s and 90s.
Right.
So Broadway's been here before, and it will come back.
Awesome. Michael, I can't tell you how great it's been to sit and talk with you for this last hour, and I thank you so much. Would love to have you on again when the third book comes out.
Well, you have to wait a little while.
We will.
Give me a break. I just finished this one. I'm dying. Right.
Absolutely. But I think
I finished the book and then I had a pandemic. All right.
That's true. That's true. You need a rest. thank you so much. And I encourage everybody to go out and buy Singular Sensation. It's well worth your time. It's a wonderful history lesson of Broadway and just celebrates an incredible decade. So Michael, thank you very much.
Thanks, Brandon. Good to talk to you.
Absolutely. Thank you. Once again, a very special thank you to Michael Riedel. Once again, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway from Simon & Schuster is available now anywhere where you can get books. Michael also recorded, he wrote a wonderful book called Razzle Dazzle a few years ago, which is about Broadway in the 70s and 80s and about a very, very important time in theater history when both Broadway and New York City were able to come back from near collapse. And that's a fascinating read too, and covers shows like A Chorus Line in Chicago and how the Andrew Lloyd Webber British Invasion sort of began in the early 80s. And so that's a wonderful book too. But once again, thank you to Michael. It was a wonderful interview, and he shared some wonderful points of view, and especially about how the current state that our world is in now and what it will take for a theater to come back. And we certainly hope it does soon. So that will do it for this episode of The Front Row. You can find us all within our own feeds, whether it's for My Show Classics or whether it's for Beyond the Mouse or Flashbacks or Guilty Pleasures or any of our other shows that are available. We all have our own feeds on iTunes. Don't forget to rate us and give us all a rating and a review. That helps people find us. And also check out our Patreon page as well. And if you would like to support us so that we can keep doing work here and getting interviews. And we have a lot more coming down the pike. Can't maybe reveal them all yet, but just keep on the lookout. So from the Front Row Network, I am Brandon Davis, and we will see you in the front row.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for listening to this episode, a proud member of the Front Row Network of shows on NPR Illinois. For the past 5 years, we've been providing hours of content every month, and now we've created the chance for all of you to get even more content. We've officially launched our Patreon page to give you the chance to support our work. There are 4 separate levels, and each come with their own amazing bonus perks, including exclusive episodes, full movie commentary tracks, and even the ability to choose what episodes we do and be on them with us. To show your support, simply go to www.patreon.com/frontrownetwork. That's patreon.com/frontrownetwork. Thank you again, and as always, we'll see you in the front row.